a landscape that I often use to meditate, located high in a mountain, in a kind of cave, and there's waterfall falling across the entrance of the cave, shielding myself from the world. So I'm in this really warm sort of dry space, and outside this huge waterfall. I think it's really about creating a space, an interior space, something that you can focus on.
I imagine this landscape myself being in the water, immersed in water, like in a rocky pool and some kind of high mountains around, like kind of, you know, a lake, listening, it lying in the water and listening to the water.
Get Up, Stand Up Now with Black creative pioneers across the generations. Episode 4, Imaginary Landscapes. Exhibition curator, Zach Ove.
Imaginary landscapes, how we look at and imagine the places that we want to be. Another paraphrase for that would be dare to dream, you know. And what and how and whom do we envision in those moments? What are the landscapes that we can encounter that we're not allowed to traverse? How do we use imaginary landscapes to break ground? How in that moment do artists envisage a world beyond?
I'm Barbie Asante. I'm an artist based in London and sometimes Amsterdam.
My name is Paul Goodwin. I'm a curator and a researcher based in London.
Hey, Paul.
Yeah.
Welcome, Paul. I would like to start off to tell you about my imaginary landscape with a quote from Catherine McKittrick's Demonic Grounds. She not only refuses a comfortable belonging to nation or country or local street, she alters them by demonstrating that geography, the material world, is infused with sensations and distinct ways of knowing, rooms full of weeping, exhausted countries, a house that is only as safe as flesh. She is writing that about the poetry of Dion Brand, who I really like.
It's interesting that we both used water in our imaginary landscapes. And I was just looking at the etymology of the word landscape, which comes from, it first appeared in English in 1603.
Which is kind of interesting, yeah. Isn't it? When we think about the colonial axis of power, right?
Exactly. But it comes from Dutch, actually. Yeah. Middle Dutch, landscape, meaning region. German, Landschaft, and Old English, Norse, landskap. But the suffix skap or skip means ship.
Plus also our bodies are, I mean, my quote was really about embodiment, you know, and a kind of female embodiment of her geography. And that is very much associated to the fact that our bodies are like, what, 80% or more water?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think water is key to understanding the African diaspora.
Well, exactly.
And the black condition. Obviously, we were transported over water. And as you say, our bodies are constituted for water. I mean, just the definition of ship relates to apparently the idea of constitution or condition or shape, meaning that the ship is something that holds existence, something that holds meaning, or something that holds
container.
Exactly. And that's something that I think is very powerful for the black experience. And for thinking about black aesthetics.
How do you think that kind of might even relate to the creative landscape that we might find ourselves in this present moment?
In terms of the history of the word landscape, I think it is related to landscape painting. So
yeah.
I think it is related to painting.
It is related
to the way that artists started to engage with nature and to imagine nature and construct nature in a certain way. I really learned about landscape painting through John Berger's ways of seeing,
yes,
where he does that brilliant analysis of the origins of Dutch landscape painting and also English landscape painting, which was a kind of imitation of the Dutch and the Belgian Flemish tradition. And that famous picture, Mr. and Mrs. Andrews, that he analyses, where you see Mr. Andrews, who's the landowner, Mrs. Andrews, the woman, sitting kind of like below him, mm-hmm. underneath this tree, and then there's a dog looking up at both of them. So it's a picture about ownership, and a lot of landscape portraiture was about ownership and about portraying the people that own the land. But what you don't see are the people that worked on the land. No. Like, you don't see the workers on the land in there. And of course, the other level of the erasure is that you don't see the fact that there was land in the Caribbean or overseas where basically Africans were working on to produce the profits that then went into making the land and right. the wealth of Europe.
And then kind of thinking about the landscape that we are in, I think as creative people now, I think that this, you know, kind of erasure is beginning to be addressed, right? Mm-hmm. In some way. It's kind of still difficult to address it because of the kind of power structures that there are. I'm the sort of person that carries the kind of legacies of my ancestors with me, like
Absolutely.
My creative ancestors. So, you know, they dreamed that they would, and somehow we're sort of fulfilling that dream, sort of, but we may be asking more different questions, or maybe asking to address different things in a different way, which I think is a really interesting time, because we're really, I don't want to bog us down, because I really want us to start imagining.
One of the artists that really made me think about landscape, both in a kind of a symbolic way, but also to engage with natural landscape, is Ingrid Pollard.
I was really thinking about Ingrid.
You can't talk about landscape talking about Ingrid Pollard's work, right?
In
the pastoral interludes.
Absolute.
When I was a curator at Tate Britain, I had a series called Conversation Pieces, a kind of mm-hmm. public program, a talk series, where I invited artists to come in, choose a work from the collection, and talk about their practice in relation to the collection, mm-hmm. to have a conversation. And I invited Ingrid in, as a photographer who'd been working on locating black bodies in the landscape. She chose, I think it was a painting by Marcus Geerhertz, a Flemish painter that did landscapes, pristine landscapes of an English country house and the kind of figures dotted in the landscape, some of whom were working, I think. And she came in and talked about the pastoral interlude pictures, where she pictured, you know, black bodies, black figures, in a contemporary setting, walking in the English landscape, and the ways in which the black body was seen, you know, as being kind of alien to that landscape, as somehow being outside of that landscape.
The kind of essence of our difference is always still over-egged whenever we're kind of in any kind of institution, I believe. And so, therefore, how do we think about going beyond that? I'm going to say, just pull in one of the performances that I'm going to be doing is... related to Horace's work, right, is Baldwin's Nigger Reloaded. And really that kind of began through a conversation with my daughter, who had initially seen Pressure and was very kind of disturbed by the women in Pressure. And the kind of like, I watched Pressure and then it just turned me on this like journey, this kind of Horace journey, and watched Baldwin's Nigger.
I'll tell you a story, if I may. Many years ago, when I first came to London, I was in the British Museum, naturally. And one of the West Indians who worked there started up a conversation with me and wanted to know where I was from. And I told him I was from Harlem. And that answer didn't satisfy him. And I didn't understand what he meant. I was born in Harlem. I was born in Harlem Hospital, I said. I was born in New York. None of these answers satisfied him. He said, where was your mother born? And I said, she was born in Maryland. And I could see, though I didn't understand it, that he was going more and more disgusted with me. He was so became more and more impatient. And where was your father born? My father was born in New Orleans. Yes, he said, but man, where were you born? And then I began to get it. You know, I said, my mother was born in Maryland, my father was born in New Orleans, I was born in New York. He said, but before that, where were you born? And I had to say, I don't know. I could see that he did not believe me. I tried to explain, you know, there's no way for me. He said, don't you care enough to find out? And I tried to explain that if I were originally from Dakar, from wherever I was in Africa, I couldn't find out where it was because my entry into America is a bill of sale. And that stops, you know, that stops you from going any further. At some point in our history, I became Baldwin's nigger. That's how I got my name.
Baldwin lays out this incredible, I would say, speculative talk about where we're going. It's quite stark. It's frank. It's really speaking to the violence at that time, and what needed to be dismantled. And there's a very provocative question from a woman in the audience who says, where do you think the black man's going to be in 50 years time?
How do you envisage the black man's personality, say, within 50 years?
He is quite hopeful.
I don't know if this is so. I'll tell you what I would like and what I hope. I think that black people, you know, that the black experience, let's put it this way, and I'm deliberately trying to distinguish the black experience from the Christian, the white Christian European experience. It seems to me that the black personality then has a kind of vigor, a kind of vitality, and a kind of a sense of life, of something which does not come from here, but comes from much deeper regions. I think the African personality is not so compartmentalized.
So when I pulled that project together with a group of young people in 2014, we were not in a hopeful situation, but I was really aware that it was almost like 50 years after the film had actually been made. And what we were experiencing then was people rereading The Fire Next Time and, Trayvon Martin. And, you know, after that, Ferguson and the terrorist attacks in Paris. And all of these have been recorded through these kind of performative process of taking the text from the film, the book, Baldwin's text, and rewriting that with people. But one of the things that I'm really keen on in that process is that somehow we embodied that text, think about that text within our present, and start to think about writing our futures.
I'll tell you a story, if I may. Many years ago, when I first came to Glasgow, I was at Glasgow Uni. I was late. I'm always late, naturally. And I was due to give a lecture. And one of the security guards who worked there started up a conversation with me and wanted to know where I was from. So I told him I was from Glasgow. And that answer didn't satisfy him, naturally. Where are you really from, he said. And I said, Glasgow, again. He became agitated. I was born in France. Silence. I was born in Lyon. Still nothing. He sighed and then said, but I mean, where are you really from? And I had to say, I'll be from wherever you want me to be from.
I think that the black experience, however you want to define that, is essential for understanding all of our futures, not just black people's futures.
Right, yeah.
It's all of our futures.
Yeah.
Blackness has been, I feel, wrongly characterized under the field of identity politics, right? I've always thought that blackness is not just about identity politics or just about a narrow thing. For centuries, there has been a universal kind of outer national understanding of blackness, right? So that goes back, for example, to the Haiti Revolution, when the constitution of the new Republic of Haiti after the revolution was founded, white people in Haiti were given honorary black status. They could be formed as black.
Wow.
But yeah, exactly. So there's always been a kind of openness and understanding to that. And I think that, and if you read, you know, Paul Gilroy's Black Atlantic, again, you know, he traces that, and Sylvia Winter, and others always talk about the openness of black people. And I think that's been misunderstood, that, you know, I think there's always a ways in which our creativity has been open to the world, right? Although the world hasn't always been open to us.
My imaginary landscape, I've been really thinking a lot about water. So actually a landscape might not be the thing, it's actually maybe waterscape. I've been thinking a lot about how water holds memories. And in fact, water holds sound for hundreds and hundreds of years.
The physical landscape that I find unforgettable, I'm in a Mokoro, that's a very shallow bottom boat, and it's being plied through the swamplands by an African man from Botswana. I am looking out at hippos that are I'm just seeing their nostrils and their ears wriggling. And it's the sound of that stick that they move the boat along, of coming up out of the water and then swishing through. I remember there was a baboon in a tree on the right side, and then the most incredible looking bug that I'd never seen before landed on a stick, on the straw, on the reeds as I went by. And I said to myself, wow, this is visual yoga. Hope you get it. My name is CCH Pounder Kone, and I am known as CCH Pounder. I was born in the West Indies. I certainly was not meant to be an actor. I was meant to be a doctor, an accountant, you know, typical West Indian fare. But I had a little cricket ball accident, hit me at the back of the head. I was in boarding school, and the nuns thought, wow, we could maybe sharpen her memory if we let her learn a poem each day. And each, at the end of the week, I would recite the poems back to a nun, and then two nuns, and then three or four nuns, and I discovered an audience of nuns. You can be walking down a street in Denmark. There is a man of color walking towards you. And even though he's saying to myself, don't stare at her just because she's black, you can actually hear him think of it. And he'll walk past you, he will not look, and you'll turn around, and there he is turning around at exactly the same moment. And it's happened to me in Russia, in Moscow, in Morocco. I remember it in Denmark. Here we are, these scattered citizens, people of the African diaspora outside of Africa, because in Africa, you're just part of the minions. But when you're out in these other places in the world, there is definitely an absolute recognition that is immediately based on color, even if you have culturally absolutely nothing in common. Which tells me that they have had an experience that is like. I, in my opinion, had one of the most beautiful childhoods I can imagine. It was. I will tell you that I saw the moon when it was green. I saw black stars. Well, I didn't think I carried around Guyana with me, because I think Guyana was always a lack for me. I was not a good girl, and I got whooped fairly regularly, at least once a day. A cane or a whip or a belt, corporal punishment was pretty common. And I found ways to dodge and get out of it, be a fast talker. I am the only child that insisted on going back. You know, I want to go on a holiday. I want to see where I lived before. I've always had that desire to go back, investigate, and check out. I'm going to read from Their Eyes Were Watching God. It's Zora Neale Hurston. And it is my favorite opening of any book that I've ever read. Ships at a distance have every man's wish on board. For some, they come in with the tide. For others, they sail forever on the horizon, never out of sight, never landing, until the watcher turns his eyes away in resignation, his dreams mocked to death by time. That is the life of men. Now, women, forget all those things they don't want to remember, and remember everything they don't want to forget. The dream is the truth. Then they act and do things accordingly. So the beginning of this was a woman, and she had come back from burying the dead, not the dead of sick and ailing with friends at the pillow and the feet. She had come back from the sudden and bloated, the sudden dead, their eyes flung wide open in judgment. The people all saw her come because it was sundown. One of the things about Zora Neale Hurston that people always got very upset about at the time when she was writing was because she wrote in the vernacular. And at that time, the black bourgeoisie wanted us to sound absolutely upscale, educated, writing. And she wanted to follow the sounds of the people that she knew. And she grew up in Eatonville, and this is the way they spoke and thought. And instead of making an imaginary sound for them, she gave them their own voices. And this upset us as bourgeoning intellectuals quite a bit. But the fact is that we have to include all of ourselves, all the different parts of us. And that's why I'm so proud of her and so pleased to read her when I can. I've been collecting now, I would say, 40 years. There are collections of diasporic art, and I'm so glad to be part of that crew. New landscapes, if we're talking about if there are new landscapes to discuss diasporic art, it's coming. It's not all here yet. Right now, it's in comparison to another landscape, a very well-established Western landscape. But we are beginning to curate, write, and discuss art residencies and museums of our very own so that as these things open up, it won't be in comparison to, it will be this is what it is. And that's the day that I'm waiting for. I have a large collection here that was in the United States, and I've decided to also make it available to the world. The moment that somebody takes on, say, an Elenatsui, studies his work, and then makes work according to what Elenatsui was creating, then we're almost there. That will be the beginning of absolutely sharing our ideas that come from the germ, the seed that is Africa, as opposed to the Western canon. And I think that's going to be essential.
I really see my practice as propositional. Like the Declaration of Independence, or I mean, I call the project Baldwin's Nigger Reloaded. These use of reenactment as a way of like really thinking about those ways that we might be able to be together, imagining what we want in the future. So maybe to be like a bit provocative and to really sort of think that through is perhaps we can kind of imagine a little maybe what a creative landscape might look like. Do you have any kind of ideas, Paul?
I think I can say what it won't look like.
Okay.
And it won't look like Wakanda.
Yeah, no. Wakanda. Let's be real about that.
I don't think it's going to look like Wakanda.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Wakanda is a patriarchal landscape.
Regardless, even if it's got a warrior force of women.
Yeah. You know, it's an extractivist landscape because to build the technology, you extract
a vibranium.
Vibranium. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a really colonial landscape in some respects. Yeah. Sorry to be, you know, to kind of debunk that. I love the movie. It's a great movie. But let's be real. Mm. Because that movie, in a way, was trying to kind of give us or sell us a vision of what a black landscape would look like.
Mm.
And I think many of us bought into that representational sense of seeing beautiful black people, you know, wearing heritage costumes and as kings and queens, etc. But actually what we were looking at was a Hollywood representation that came from the original imagination of a white man. Stan Lee is a brilliant writer and brilliant comic artist. And I've read some of the original Black Panther comics, and they're really interesting. But nonetheless, they don't represent really the black experience. I mean, I think the critical landscape to the future will come from black women. I think that's where it's coming from, because it's no coincidence that the greatest black science fiction writer is Terrier Butler, a woman, right? And if you look at the kind of incredible writing at the moment that are black geographies, you know, Catherine McKittrick, you know, Sylvia Winter, Horace Spillers, you know,
Hortense Spillers,
Saidiya Hartman. I mean, the name, it goes on and on. The kinds of, you know, all of these, this imagination is really driving, I think, where the future is. So I don't have the answer.
We're doing our bit. But let me see if I can, like, kind of extend on that. And if we think about, you know, a black feminist kind of statement, like the personal is political, the kind of root of that was because they were thinking really about the kind of personal affects, the things that affect black women's lives that become political. I mean, those are to do with family, they're to do with oppression of sexuality, rape. I think one of the wonderful things that black women have brought together is like testimony, writing. We live in a world where we've been growing in this kind of much more me society. So even though we're really about a change, we're also kind of blocked by ourselves. And we have a lot of trauma and we have a lot of stuff that we need to bring. So in a way, we need that being really with our bodies, right? And our embodiment. And how we would like to be treated and how we would like to treat others. So I'm also thinking that it becomes very difficult maybe sometimes to bring that into kind of some of the institutional spaces. Every time I'm making a piece of work and I'm putting it into an institution, I'm putting it into an institution whose history is really deeply linked, even if they're a new institution that's only 5 years old. But if we're still creating particular kind of forms of exhibition making, we're still kind of repeating those things. And there is a remembrance for me of the fact that as I'm bringing in work into an exhibition space, that I was exhibited, you know, that my ancestors were exhibited in particular ways, whether that be on an auction block. That's the power propositions that I bring into this space. And I feel that that is the way that we might start to really grapple with how we create our futures and start to imagine them.
Imaginary landscapes. About time I get out here, head back to Niger. One way ticket, or go one cheaper, see if I can bilk it. Tear up my passport, head down Home Office, see if they keep promises. Could Her Majesty finance my exit, please? And what does one say to a spurned mother? Will she turn her nose up as the airplane turns its nose down on the runway? Thunderstorms for a welcome mat. We didn't get on the first time still. Corrugated roofs as a shock to my system. Where are your chimneys? Where are your cobblestones? Under the hot sun, even with a mouthful of moi moi, always had a longing throat, hungry for the horizon. London just had more familiar nectar. It wasn't nothing personal. I wasn't even born here. I spent a whole time in my hometown with my own tribe, thinking I do not belong here. This was temporary, a terrible mistake, a Dan Aykroyd from Trading Places, an unfairness. And now I've spent two lemon-haired chicken decades under hostile weather, Britain. The lens in my mind go rose-tinted and strays. I dream of 90s hip-hop busting out of busted speakers at the back of rusty minivans. Dusty road wind tickling my nappy hair. Pawpaw trees as common as lampposts. And I'm as misty as a 38 bus window in winter, toying with the idea of going back. Thank you for listening to Get Up, Stand Up Now, Imaginary Landscapes. And you have heard the voices of Barbie Asante, Paul Goodwin, CCH Pounder, Zach Ove, and me, Joshua Eden. The music was by Geiger. This has been a reduced listening production for Somerset House. The producer was Femi Oriogun Williams. You can subscribe and hear other editions of the podcast on iTunes and all other major podcast platforms. Just search Somerset House on your podcast app. And if you're in London and you're listening before the 15th of September 2019, then make sure you check out the exhibition Get Up, Stand Up Now, curated by Zach Ove for Somerset House.